This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Do you think that I might forget all my love? It's radiating further away.
You're with the Priest, the Pom, and the Poof on the Spirit Lounge, the show that explores sexuality and spirituality for our community.
Welcome to Spirit Lounge, and you're with Joy.
And Andrew.
And
Peter the panellist.
And our love goes out to Bertie the Pom, who's in bed and she's not well. We love you, Bertie, and we miss you. Come back next week.
Yes, hopefully you get well very soon. What have we got today?
Well, you know how last week we talked about seven deadly sins?
Yes, yes.
And we sort of came up with a modern version of Seven Deadly Sins, didn't we?
We did. We had, and Bertie came up with some amazing ones, actually, that were quite good.
Yes. And one of them was, we talked about one of the sins being the destruction and disrespect of our environment.
Yes. I think that was the one that we all kind of agreed on. Yes. We were like, maybe we should have mentioned that.
Probably even the Catholic Church, didn't they?
Catholic Church had, there's a bit of a publication that was, I think it was bandied about around in 2008, that mentioned that that environmental concerns should possibly be included in the list.
Yes. Well, Andrew and I had the privilege of actually interviewing the producer of a documentary that's going to be shown at the Human Rights Arts and Film Festival this coming Friday. So we're going to talk to her, and it's about environmental issues.
It was a fascinating interview. I wish that we had a bit more time to be able to kind of talk to her a little bit more, but unfortunately we didn't. The Human Rights and Arts Film Festival is an amazing project, actually. So we'll go a little bit more detail for that a bit later.
But first we're going to talk about an incident that happened on Saturday in Adelaide. And for those who haven't heard about this, the gays and Christians clashed in a street rally. Did you hear about that, Andrew?
There was a little segment on the news, and I was quite impressed that, you know, it actually made it to the news, and there was like proper footage and everything, you know. I don't know. It was a bit of excitement for the town of Adelaide, I think.
So there was a rally, and the rally was to mark International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. And there was about, apparently, 150 members of the gay and lesbian community staged a mass wedding.
So this is part of the Equal Rights for Gay Marriage campaign.
Yeah. Yep. And some other people from a church called Street Church decided that they were going to crash the rally. And there was a little set-to happened, and one protester said that she'd been pulled out of her wheelchair, and one of the street church members claimed that he was mobbed and he was hit, and the police actually had to step in and remove some of the street preachers. But they didn't actually arrest anyone.
No, they didn't arrest anyone. I think the words they used were, "You're not keeping the peace." So yeah, yeah. But interesting that they actually forcibly removed someone. I think even if they didn't press charges, it has to be pretty serious if somebody has to get forcibly removed.
Yeah, so I decided to do a little investigation about this street church, and they're not a very nice lot, really, I've decided. There's not very Christian of them. And they're apparently a Pentecostal church. I'd never heard of them before. And they appear to be a part of a group called Moriah Ministries. There seems to be on their website a lot of talk of the wrath of God and sin and eternal damnation, and that's not even mentioned together with homosexuality, but lots of other things.
Seems that the anger is directed all over the place.
Isn't it interesting?
Interestingly enough, I'll just read a little bit from the website, from their website. They believe the Pope is the Antichrist, and the majority of the Assemblies of God, Baptist Church, Church of Christ, Uniting Church, and plenty of other denominations in Australia have been corrupted by a false gospel and a lack of teaching on biblical assurance of salvation. So they're kind of like pushing away from many of the mainstream religious organisations in Australia.
Yeah, I think so. But it's always a worry when one church, and from what I can see, there's only one of them, claims to have all the answers and everyone else is wrong. Peter's put up his hand. Do you think he wants to speak?
I think he wants to interrupt us.
Does that make them a cult?
Yeah, it's a fine line, isn't it? I wouldn't like to call that, make a call on that, but you've got to worry. I love what they say about women. We are forbidden to instruct in matters of the faith, but rather are to remain silent in subjection to their husbands, learning from them. We believe women define this scriptural command actively engaged in rebellion and witchcraft.
So I think what they're trying to say is you can't have the priesty title that we give you.
They wouldn't like me because I'm a minister.
Don't think they like anyone in this room, actually.
You're joining a great group, Joy.
Don't worry, we're good people. But I think it's really interesting that this one particular group is really vocal, and unfortunately, that's kind of the face of the church that many members of the gay and lesbian community see. So, like, I've seen it before. Like, I went and marched in Pride March, and there was a member of the church, like, standing on top of the bus stop, like, yelling down that I'm going to go to hell and stuff. And I was kind of like, you know, I don't really agree with what you're saying right now. I'm not really sure that anyone's going to listen to you a message being delivered in this way. But it did make me a bit disappointed, because I know that the majority of Christian churches that I know of are actually quite supportive of the gay and lesbian community.
Yeah, I wouldn't think that would be the general rule, though. I think in Australia, if you looked at them, there would be probably more that are anti. But most of them wouldn't come out like these people and actually go out into the street and confront members of our community. But remember Fred Nile, I don't know if he's still alive even, but, you know, as you say, that's the people that's the type of people that we hear about. And yet, for many of us who are Christians, that's not how people act. And yeah, it's not what people think, as you say. But anyway, I just want to mention here that if you are in or have been in a Pentecostal charismatic church, and that if you're looking for a social and support group, there is a group called Freedom to Be, and we had Linda, who's one of the organisers of this group, come in and speak to us.
She was so great.
Yeah,
I
she's
really
fabulous,
loved
isn't
meeting
she?
Her.
Their meeting is on this Friday. They have a monthly meeting, and it's at 7:15 p.m. apparently for a 7:30 start. And it is at the Victorian AIDS Council building, number 6 Claremont Street, South Yarra. The entrance is at the side of the building. Just ring the doorbell. This sounds a bit spooky, doesn't it? We'll come and let you in. Ooh. Afterwards, they're going to La Pochettas in Trout Road, South Yarra. That sounds good. The topic this month is gratitude and growth, and it's remembering those who have helped us on our life's journey. And if you want any further information, go to their website, which is freedom, followed by the number 2, and then the letter b.org.
There's actually, interestingly enough, this the whole protest thing that happened in Adelaide was the group were actually marking International Day Against Homophobia. So the Idaho Day's kind of gotten a bit of exposure in the mainstream media as well, which is kind of double-edged sword, I guess. There's good exposure and then there's exposure. but the Uniting Church is doing a little bit of their own Idaho Day thing tomorrow, actually. So it's happening. It's a bit of a space where you can reflect and say a prayer and write a note to someone who you're thinking about, or if you want to just sit and be in the space, you can. It's happening tomorrow. It's the 17th of May at Monash University Peninsula Campus, Building A in the George Jenkins Foyer 2. And it's from 1:30 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. So get along there and kind of get involved.
That sounds good. Now, Andrew, you're going to introduce our first track, and all our music tonight is about the environment. So over to you.
This one is by Julian Lennon. It's Salt Water. And every time that I hear this song, kind of like hits me right there.
Hey, this is Corey Monteith from Glee, and you're listening to Australia's gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
There Once Was an Island is a documentary about the indigenous people of Taku having to make an impossible decision. Water is rising, and as their land starts to disappear, their way of life is under threat. But there are more immediate dangers. As they prepare for a terrifying tidal flood to rip through their community, they must ask the question, do we stay or do we leave our homeland forever? This documentary reveals the human face of climate change, challenging us to consider our relationship to the earth and the other people on it. And tonight is our privilege to talk to the producer of Once Was an Island. Welcome to Spirit Lounge, Lynn Colley.
Hi, thank you.
How did you first hear about Taku Island and the plight of its people?
Actually, it was the director of the film, Brian March, who spearheaded it, the project, and she was attracted to the story because Richard Moyle, who was working on the island, has worked on the island as a musicologist with the community. He was speaking about the situation there, and she was really fascinated by the idea of a sinking island and wanted to find out more, and we sort of, as we got into it, we subsequently realised that the island wasn't really sinking, that there were other things happening, and that we were really looking at the first impacts of climate change for people there. But that's how we came to the story.
Most of us would never have heard about Taku Island. Where on earth would you find it?
Taku is part of the autonomous region of Bougainville, which is in Papua New Guinea, and it's just to the... Bougainville is to the east of the main part of PNG, and Taku is to the east of Bougainville again. So it's about 250 kilometres northeast of Booker Township, which is in Bougainville.
I believe
quite a long way away.
I believe it's very small. I think I read somewhere there's 180 adults. Is that right?
I'm not entirely sure if it's 180 adults, but that makes sense because the statistic that I'm familiar with is that there's about 400 people on the island. It goes up and down because expats move on and off. Sometimes if it's censused, it's more like 600, I think, especially if everyone's home for Christmas. And then at quieter times in the year, it can be, lower, like maybe 400. But I don't believe there's been a recent census. I might be wrong, that's the guesstimate.
Can you tell us a little bit about the people who live on the island and a little bit about the culture there?
The culture on Taku is still has traditional Polynesian elements, and people still practice elements of traditional Pacific voyaging religion, which is quite unusual because there's been extensive missionary activity in the region for a long time. And that is sort of similar to other Pacific cosmologies, so ancestors are still with you, and the land is really important, and obviously the ocean is really important because you're right in it. The life on the island is really pretty simple. It's not that dissimilar to other parts of PNG or the Solomons, which is quite close to Taku on the other side. So it's village life. There's no, like the houses are made out of like stick frames with coconut mat, like wall panels. So it's really simple. It's almost like being in a tent, but a bit darker. And they have just the coral sand of the island is what you have inside the house. And then they're thatched with pandanus leaf. And there's no kind of sanitation, so people use the ocean. And it seems to work fine. There's not sort of problems from that. But it's just very simple. It's a very simple way of life. So they have some, they dress with, they wear T-shirts and lap-laps, which are just sort of sections of fabric, and that comes in from off the island. But they're still kind of farming and supporting themselves as much as they can. So they eat taro and fish, and there's some food from off the island, but it's just simple and focused on a sort of daily routine of getting food and you know, dressing it and cooking it and eating it.
So they sound as though they're quite a deeply spiritual people.
I would say that, like with any community, there's variations in that. So some people are, and there's actually quite a lot of Christian churches present on the island as well as the practice of the traditional religion. And there's quite a gender split. So the women of the island are quite Christian, like they're more likely to be involved in the churches, the Christian churches, and the men tend to be more involved with the traditional cosmology and ways of thinking. And there are people who are not very spiritual, and there are quite a lot of quite agnostic people, I would say. I mean, you know, from visiting the island, and there are, you know, there are people who are more passionately involved with the spiritual dimension of their lives. So it runs the gamut. Probably, I would say, if you compare the Taku community to like a regular community in the West, they would be much more spiritually aware and focused than that. Than a typical Western community.
Yeah, a question that is probably totally irrelevant to everyone, but if they're such a small population, who do they marry?
There are really, really strict rules about who you can marry. And, I mean, if you think logically, that's really to preserve as much genetic diversity on the island as possible. But the family trees are very complex. We have three characters in our story, and they're all related to each other, twice on one side and once on the other. Every generation, I did do a little family tree just trying to see how everyone was organised, and it quickly became too complicated to deal with because it was very circular. But it's not, I mean, I have to stress this, you know, people are dealing with a very small population and they are careful to deal with that appropriately. So in every generation, you notice that there's someone who's come in from another island or from off the island at least once. So they maintain genetic diversity that way, if you'll pardon the rather biological terminology. But yeah, no, people are very, there are very clear rules about who you can marry. And by and large, those are still adhered to, actually.
And you're on Spirit Lounge with Joy the Priest and Andrew the Poof. And we've been talking with Lynn Colley. We're going to play another track, and it's by a band called Tivaka, and it's actually made up of members whose ancestors come from countries including Tokelau and Tuvalu, which are both islands in the Pacific that are under threat from climate change also. And the first album is translated A Different Land, and they actually dedicated this track to Greenpeace and all other environmental groups. But it's about a journey, because it's in their native language, it's actually about a journey back to the island that they were so proud of, only to find out that things had changed, and they're expressing their sadness, how they were overcome with sadness. And in the last verse they talk about, we need to find a way to make us proud again. So here's A Different Land from Tivaka.
Oh, no. Hi, I'm Cyndi Lauper, and if you just want to have fun, do you? Keep listening to Joy 94.9 FM.
And you're on Spirit Lounge with Joy and Andrew. And if you would like to join in the conversation like Lee and Grant have, you can SMS on 0427-JOY949. You could ring on 1300-JOY949, like someone did to mention that they loved the music. And you can email onair@joy.org.au. And tonight we are talking to Lynn Colley, who is the producer of the documentary Once There Was an Island.
So what exactly is happening to cause the people to consider moving from the island?
So what's happening on the island that's really quite difficult for people is basically it's to do with, well, there are two main things. There's sort of weather and coastal erosion, which makes people quite neurotic, and gradual loss of the gardens. Now, so what's happening is that people perceive that there is a lot of coastal erosion, and they're trying to use seawalls to prevent that from getting worse and to build out the land that they can build on, because with 400 people on a very small island, you know, that's quite an issue, like having enough space for everybody. But the seawalls are actually causing sand which would otherwise be deposited on the beach to get bounced back into the lagoon, so they're not really helping. That said, we did survey, and the island is not it's not disappearing as fast as people perceive, but they are quite worried about it, so that is a pressure on them to sort of move, and what they're doing isn't really helping. But I think the community isn't really sure about what to do with that information, so things have remained quite static. I don't think anyone's taken down the seawalls, for example. But the other thing that's happening that's quite difficult is it's expected that weather events, extreme weather events like one that you see in the film, we have it on screen, are expected to get much more frequent. So the last time a really large flood happened was about 50 years ago. Then we had one in 2008, which we filmed. And scientists are predicting that that as the sea rises, those will become exponentially more frequent, which is very difficult when you're right on the sea, right on the waterline, which they basically are. They're only 1 metre above sea level. The other issue is, well, the other issue is that the island, as the sea comes up, there's salt water finding its way into the, we think, into the fresh water lens, and that is then finding its way into the taro gardens. So the deepest gardens are becoming stalinated, and that's causing the plants in them to die. Not everybody is gardening as much as they did in the past, because there's a lot of movement of expats on and off, and you need to sort of stick around and train to garden, and you need to do it. You need to be there to do it. But it is definitely causing some food security problems, particularly since, and this is the real issue, there's really very little contact possible with the outside on a regular basis. They're not that far from Bougainville, but because of the poverty in the region and because of the way the government is just not able to provide a service, they don't get the boat out to the island very often, and it's hard to call. Sometimes the satellite phones on the island are up and sometimes they're not. And so people don't know. People know that if something goes really wrong and there's a big weather event, they're not going to know about it, or they may not. And even if they do, there may be no help available.
I guess. What about drinking water?
They collect rainwater in polythene tanks, just standard tank you'd see in any rural environment in New Zealand or Australia. So there are a few dwellings around, or the two men's houses have corrugated iron roofs, so they collect the water from those and it's stored communally. And some families who have a tin roof will also collect water. And the PNG government has been quite good at providing tanks for people. So typically there is enough water. It comes and goes. There is one bore on the island, but the water is fairly brackish, so people don't drink it unless they really have to.
And it sounds like it's quite an interesting environment. I imagine it would have presented quite a few challenges for making the film. How did you kind of overcome these challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a real production nightmare. The biggest problem we had was that the boat doesn't go very often, and it's quite, although there is a schedule, it doesn't really keep to schedule. So the first problem I had was that we had to fly everything in. We didn't have very much money, and we had a really small crew, but we had to change tickets, and it was going to cost way more than we had. And fortunately, our travel agent managed to kind of juggle things around, so it was okay, and I managed to get the crew through the boat in time. But the other challenge is that when you're flying coach, as you do, at Christmas time when it's busy, Air New Guinea will put off baggage. Like, it'll, if you have something in the, if you've got checked baggage, they sometimes they just leave it and leave it for another aircraft to bring later. And we had a situation where we didn't know when the boat was going, and we didn't really, we knew that we needed to take all of our equipment onto the aircraft as carry-on. So we had to juggle to make sure we had really light solar panels, because there's no electricity system on the island. So some people have solar and some people have generators, and we knew we were going to have something to charge our batteries. So it was really important that we took all of our power generation and all of our shooting equipment, very basic, so all of the tape stock, the camera, the tripod, and and one of the solar panels, which was a portable fold-up solar panel, all went onto the aircraft with the crew, so that we knew even if all their clothes and the rest of the gear was left behind, we could still get the film in the can.
You'd almost have to book its own seat just for the equipment.
No, it went as the 7kg carry-on. We just did it that way.
Did you get to take any clothes?
They checked their clothes. But, I mean, the thing is, once you get to book it, we also had to, we knew we would be, for the first shoot, we knew that we wouldn't have time to shop for the equipment we needed to take, like plastic chairs and, like, little rubber mattresses to sleep on and stuff like that, you know, gifts for people, and extra food. You take food with you to give to the family you're staying with, so you're not eating them out of house and home. So we got the New Zealand police stationed in Booker to help us to do that. They actually shot for everything and gave the crew a giant pile of receipts and all the equipment. I was amazed at that. I mean, that's so kind. We couldn't have done it without them. And this is going back to 2006, but it still blows me away that they did that. They were so helpful. It was great. It was lots of things like that, just trying to figure out what you needed to take and how to get it through customs. Like, we tried to take a generator on our second shoot, and I tried to take one from New Zealand, but it was just going to be ridiculous. Like, the aircraft won't carry anything that's had any fuel in it, and we couldn't freight it in. It was going to take ages. So we ended up purchasing a generator in Booker and taking that on the boat, and that was what we did. And we used a charter boat. We were able to use a charter boat on the second shoot, so that was a lot easier because we could determine the exact dates that we were going.
What do we say to our ancestors when all the fish are gone? I give you my voice. Together we make a stand. We're making the right choice.
Hello, this is Gretel Colleen, and you're tuned into Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
You're on the Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9, and the track that we just listened to was called Our Ocean from Tivaka. And today we've been talking to Lynn Colley, who's produced a documentary about an island which is becoming victim to climate change. The documentary is called There Once Was an Island, and we're going to have a chat to Lynn now.
I only watched the trailer of the documentary, but I actually found even watching it quite an emotional experience. For you personally, did you find the whole thing a spiritual journey or emotional journey?
I think I did find it a spiritual journey in some ways, which is a sort of a question you don't get asked that often. But it's interesting because some people have asked me before, people have before asked me a similar sort of question, which is, did you find the experience of shooting really moving? Did you feel really sorry for people? And actually, in answer to that, I would say no. I mean, actually, it's kind of a testament to our editor and the guy that the the editor who came in and did the trailer for us, that it does move you that way, because when you're hanging out on the island, you know, people are really resourceful and they're getting on with their lives. You don't feel really sorry for them. They're kind of like New Zealanders, and I guess Australians too. They have some issues they need to deal with, and they've got some resources, and they just go ahead and do what they can. They're not sitting around wringing their hands. But I think what you do come across when you travel into an environment which is so different to the West, that you're very aware of the resources that you have at your disposal. And I definitely was changed by being in that environment. I came away feeling very, very lucky to be in the place where I am and to have what I am. And that sense of being quite blessed has stayed with me. I'm focusing fairly much on the material elements of it, but also just the possibilities you have to make choices about what your life will be, which are not present on Taku for lots of reasons. I don't have an official kind of religious affiliation, I guess, but certainly I found that going to the island made me very much appreciate what I have, and it made me quite determined to try and help. I mean, I got very focused on healthcare because there isn't really very much of it, and particularly there's no medical evacuation possible. So, well, not none, but it's difficult and it's sporadic and it doesn't always happen. So I'm trying to figure out ways of helping people have more access to emergency healthcare in the very first instance. And yeah, I was moved to do that by the journey.
No doubt along your journey you would have formed some close relationships with the people of Taku. Have you been able to keep in contact at all?
Yeah, I sponsored our intern to complete 1 year of high school, which is all I could afford. And she's still waiting for her certificate to come through, but it was a successful journey for her. And particularly I was really excited because she had a baby during the time she was studying, but she still managed to kind of complete all her assignments and pass, which is amazing.
Wow, that can be such a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be a challenge for anyone, let alone the situation she was in, was quite full on. So yeah, definitely have maintained contact with her, and particularly with Anda, because Anda lives in Papua New Guinea, so it's possible to call. It's very hard to get in contact directly with the island because satellite phones aren't always working, and because over the phone, the fact that people all speak English as a second language is really quite a challenge. So you sort of end up, I think, semaphoring what you mean a lot more in person, and it's harder to do that over the phone. So I just, because it's a bit hard to make yourself understood, I find myself not keeping in contact with people on the island, just because there are little barriers to doing so. But I'm also part of the expatriates email mailing list, so I kind of... Yeah, I'm in contact with the island that way. So I guess, I mean, the relationships that we formed with people on Taku are subject to the same kind of attrition that you would see in any kind of distance relationship, but it's exacerbated because you can't keep in contact via the internet, which is how I keep in contact with a lot of my friends who are not in the same place as me. So yeah, it's text messaging and calls, and yes, I am definitely still in touch with in reasonably regular contact with Anda and with Rose, who I sponsored.
What has happened to the island of Taku since you made the documentary?
Not so much. I'm not entirely sure how the physical situation is in terms of, you know, whether the sedimentation in the lagoon has gotten worse, or if there's been more obvious coastal erosion, or if there are more gardens impacted by the salination. But in terms of the government's offer to resettle the people, I know that they're kind of not... People are definitely working towards it, but it doesn't seem to be progressing very quickly. So, you know, people are still on the island, and no, there's been no mass relocation since then.
Right.
There has been a problem with the boat, which is not so great. They haven't been able to get, I think at the start of the year, they weren't able to get the teachers from, there's a school that runs on the island for primary school students, and the teachers weren't able to get over at the start of the year because there was a problem with the transport, and I'm not entirely sure if that's been resolved yet.
Goodness me. If people want to purchase a DVD, they can do it through your website?
That's correct, yep. We did. We have the feature-length version of the film is now available, and we're going to have, in all areas, 56-minute version of the film available, hopefully within the next month or so. So if you're wanting, if people are out there and listening and they're interested in a film that will be suitable for use in the classroom, you might want to wait for that. But yeah, absolutely. And you have the option of choosing something for personal use or for screening in your organisation, or you can organise a community screening if you'd like to.
So that's There Once Was an Island.com. And I must say that it's a fabulous website and there's some wonderful information and also some information on what can you do about this. I thought that was a really good link to have a look at.
Fantastic, yeah. We're in the process of setting up a trust, so if anyone's out there and they'd like to make a donation to the island, it's our intention that the expenditure of the money, all the decisions about that will be made by the community, and we'll help them to, like, get the money in the right place. We don't have anything you can click through to at the moment, but if anyone is interested in contributing, would be so glad to hear from you, and please email me. There's an email address on the website.
And also the documentary's been screened here in Melbourne on Friday night, which is the 20th of May, 6:30 at ACME, and this is part of the Human Rights Arts and Film Festival. And if you want to get tickets to that, and I suggest that you do, looking, just going by the short clip I've seen, it's hraff.org.au. Lynn Colley, thank you so much for being on Spirit Lounge.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hi, my name is Josh Thomas, and you're listening to Joy 949, which is it's for gay people.
And you're on Spirit Lounge with Andrew and Joy. And I just want to refer to an email received from Lee and say thank you for your email, Lee. And it really seems to be enough there that we could have a whole program discussing the points you've raised. But I just want to suggest that one thing we need to do, and this is in response to what we talked about with this church that had a clash with the gay and lesbian people in Adelaide, that we really need to make a distinction, I think, between religion and spirituality, because it really is the religion that is what is, I guess, abusive towards especially people in our community, but we still are all spiritual people, and I think we need to connect with our spirituality. For some of us, an expression of that is Christianity. For others, it might be Buddhism. For others, it's Hinduism. And even atheists are spiritual people. So I think we need to probably make a distinction there. Anyway, then we went on to interview the fabulous Lynn Collier. Wasn't she amazing to talk to?
Lynn was amazing. I wish that we had some more time to talk to her. She was so
good. We must confess we did talk a little longer off air and decide that we could solve the problems of
there was Taku people. There was a lot of solving going on. don't know whether our plans will ever get implemented, though.
I would say no.
Probably not, no.
I don't think the politicians are that interested, really, in listening to us.
Mm.
But we moved the whole island to an island in Queensland, didn't we, in the end?
That was one proposed solution.
Yeah.
Not sure whether that will get carried through. If you're actually interested in her film, which I'm going to go and see, I think it will be amazing. It's on at ACME. And if you need more info, it's hraff.org.au, and it's part of the Human Rights and Arts Festival.
I'm going to be away. I'm going to miss it. But I'm going to buy the DVD because I think it's absolutely, just from the clip I saw, it's amazing. So I think. Now, our last song for tonight, it goes so quickly, doesn't it, really?
It does. 1 hour is just not enough.
No. And next week, I'm going to be missing, but the POM and the Poof will be talking about
the
what?
POM and I will be holding down the fort, and we're going to be talking a little bit about Buddhism, and we're going to hopefully learn a little bit, because I feel like I don't really know, and I want to learn, And I want everybody to learn. So tune in next week for that.
And our last song is I Need to Wake Up, quite appropriate, isn't it? Melissa Etheridge, and it's from the documentary An Inconvenient Truth.
Have I been sleeping? I've been so still afraid of...
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.